So I want to thank the organizers for inviting me. And then it's my chance to introduce myself. So my name is Esther Betran. I come from the University of Texas, Arlington. But as Marty said, some of the work I want to present today here initiated in Manuel Long Lab and is related to the patterns of gene duplication. And I also introduce sex chromosome evolution because some of the things that I'm going to say about the gene duplication, I'm going to more or less assume that people know how sex chromosomes are evolving. So the first part is an introduction to that. So the outline is I want to introduce sex chromosomes evolution, and I say it in plural because we have the X and we have the Y chromosome. And then retroposition, and I'm not going to talk about other types of duplication just apart from mentioning them, is the mechanism that we have been studying the most. Then I say recent surprises. For some of you are not so recent, you have read about them, but from the classical view of sex chromosome evolution that I present in the introduction, there are some one can think about, they are recent surprises. On the patterns of gene duplication that now make the X chromosome behave a lot more dynamically than we thought. And then some other surprises also in the Y chromosome that, again, I don't think they are so recent either, but those are things that we see are happening with the sex chromosomes that relate to duplication, so I wanted to mention them. And I will not be covering every aspect that goes on with the sex chromosomes, so in the summary I just dump a bunch of things, say, you know, I haven't told you about this that goes on with sex chromosomes, and you need to read about it, or we all need to read about it, because we are getting more and more data all the time. So, and to explain the patterns, I'll go through two main hypotheses that have been out there, and I'm trying to give my view on them. And then another thing that's coming out now is meiotic drive, and I will have to take a detour to tell you about that, because we have several genes that could be playing this role and are being duplicated in several lineages independently. So I take a detour for that. So as I said, there are a lot of, the view is there are a lot of different sex chromosome systems out there, and they have evolved independently. So we have the same themes occurring over and over again in different lineages. And I'm going to focus on the theme of what has occurred in the human sex chromosomes that we probably all are more interested in. I also work a lot in Drosophila, so I will be telling you things about humans, mammals, and also Drosophila. And a lot of it is our work, mainly for the patterns, but you will see there is work of other people as well that are giving us a lot of information. So this is our sex determining system. We have a X and we have a Y chromosome, and they are very different. But I show you that they didn't start the journey this way. They were two autosomes to begin with, and probably there was some environmental sex determination at that time. But now we have a chromosome, X chromosome, that's believed to just keep its gene content. And then another chromosome, that's the Y chromosome, that now has shrink. Is not all the Y chromosomes always shrink, some of them grow, but they just end being very heterochromatic, containing very few genes. And so what we know is that this morphological difference is also related to gene content. So the X might contain around 1,200 genes, and the Y contains around 78 genes. And this number changed a lot after the Y chromosome was sequenced, because we discovered many of the genes are duplicated. And that's the story that I will tell you at the end. So we thought we had 30 genes, but later we realized we have many. When the Y chromosome was sequenced, and it was very difficult to do it, we can come back to that later, we realized the organization of the Y chromosome and also gene content increased a little bit, and we had many insights on the content now. So I said the journey begins with these two chromosomes being autosomes, and we have the SRY, sex determining region of the Y, that is born, and that's really a gene. At the beginning was called just this region because you know this region is enough, but what we know is that it's really a single gene that's derived from the SOX3 gene.
What was the color coding?
Here?
No,
in here, mainly heterochromatic regions are in red, I think. Some coding in dark, and then thank you for asking about that. These violet regions are what is called pseudoautosomal regions. They still pair, so these chromosomes need to pair for segregation. And in these regions, they really recombine, so the gene content in these regions is like autosomal content. So I think that's the color coding.
Sorry, I still don't understand the color coding. What is green?
I think the green is. Yeah, green definitely. The X is very much gene content, so probably to chromatin. And then red heterochromatin, and then the dark black. I cannot say from this paper what it is. So the whole journey begins with SOX3, that is a DNA binding protein, a transcription factor that can trigger the expression of many other genes. But what happened is that we first, and some people call it genic sex determination, but you could think about already having proto-sex chromosomes because they all look the same, but now an allele of SOX3, that's an allele of SOX3, is recruited to be at the top of the cascade of sex determination in humans. And if you have that allele instead of this one, and that's just a sequence variant, right? You have that allele, and it could be also part expressed differently. You will be a male now. So the SRY is now a gene that leads to maleness. What happens after that, and I'm gonna go explain a little bit more detail of this step, but just think that after that's there, it seems that very much what we know is that once a proto-sex chromosome forms, very fast, it's gonna end in this situation. Sex chromosomes are gonna form, and then the X in this case and the Y are gonna be morphologically very different.
So all mammals have exactly the same thing, or birds are different, right?
Birds, yeah, we can talk about that. I didn't wanna put all of that information, but the birds have ZZZW sex determination. That's also true for butterflies, for some snakes, and some amphibians as well. And then XY, we have Drosophila. We have worms that have XO sex determination.
This particular outcome,
when someone tells you we have a XY sex determination system, this is probably what happened. If it's not due to the presence of a SRY gene, so a maleness gene, it's due to some counting mechanism that counts how many X chromosomes are there, but that counting mechanism is not present in the Y chromosome, so then you still get some way of telling this is the Y chromosome. And this is usually what happens. And what the people think goes on through this process of degeneration is that the once you have one gene that leads to maleness, you have other genes that probably express in both sexes that could be variable. And I draw here that this gene has different alleles, and one allele performs better in males, but is not the best allele for females. We say hurts females. And the other allele is better for females, but is not the best in the males. If you have these situations, and it's very likely that we have many of these genes all around, these are called antagonistic, sexual antagonistic genes. If a rearrangement, in particular an inversion, would occur in the Y chromosome now, these things can recombine. So if the blue is not together with the SRY, after recombination it could be. So at some point you will have this combination, and if that combination is there, an inversion would be beneficial. If it occurs, it will probably be the best Y chromosome in the population and will fix. So now you have an inversion that I draw like this. Now I place SRY in different order and this blue. So this whole chunk got inverted. And I don't know if you all know, inversions prevent recombination, factually prevent recombination. And we'll see three things that can happen. Mainly that lead to degeneration of the Y chromosome now that recombination is inhibited. But usually what you have is a good combination, but now you are not recombining anymore, so that's bad. Not being able to recombining will be bad. But in addition, these two regions that are now not recombining, they are gonna differentiate. So, now, not only this blue gene is going to be different, but anything in the middle is not recombining, so it's going to be differentiating from the other. So you can date the event by looking at the genes that are there, and this has been done.
Can you repeat why the inversion is beneficial in the first place?
If you have a gene that is leading to producing only males. This is the gene that if you have it, you are a male. If it's linked to the alleles that are beneficial for the male, it's better. Make this male better. So so that type of sexual antagonistic pressure to link all the alleles of the particular gene that are male beneficial despite hurting the males, link them to the Y, is going to be a sexual antagonistic pressure that's going to drive this system to inhibit recombination now. And then we can date the event because the things are going to now evolve, going to differentiate. And I just want to quickly point to the three things that are believed to lead to the degeneration of the Y chromosome. And the three things after you prevent recombination between this chromosome that's only passed through male, and now this region cannot recombine with the X chromosome, you are going to accumulate deleterious mutations. The ones that are lethal are not going to accumulate, but others that are not lethal, just deleterious, that are not immediately eliminated, they can accumulate in different genes, and now you don't have a way to recombining them out. So you don't have a way to create a chromosome that doesn't have deleterious mutations. That's what's called Muller ratchet. The other way, and those are theoretical hypotheses. The other possibility is hitchhiking. So you have a favorable mutation. You have a favorable mutation that's gonna fix. And if it's favorable enough, it might be linked to deleterious mutations that will fix at the same time. So. In this paper, they say concomitantly you can fix these deleterious alleles on the same chromosome. And then background selection, since you are accumulating these deleterious mutations, you might be just selecting them again, the ones that are strongly deleterious, then you might be selecting them again against. That reduces your population size. When you reduce the population size, the selection is less efficient. So from that side, you are again gonna accumulate more mildly deleterious mutations. So these are the three proposed mechanisms, probably all of them operating in Drosophila from young sex chromosomes, and the work of Doris Bachrock and Charles Ward, Brian Charles Ward. It seems that this is what might be going on from the type of diversity we find. So probably quite a lot of favorable mutations that fix concomitantly with deleterious mutations going on. But in summary, the fact that it doesn't recombine will lead to the accumulation of deleterious mutations and the degeneration of the Y chromosome. A fraction of those will be just transposable elements that are inserted in genes that maybe lost already function or not. In humans, we know this happened in 4 events, so not a single inversion, but then additional positive selection to fix another inversion with additional antagonistic genes, and this went on 4 times, 1, 2, 3, and 4. And then there was even a translocation from another chromosome, and this is what is drawn here, the expansion of the pseudoautosomal region. This black region here comes from a different chromosome now, and translocated there probably to extend the pseudoautosomal region. That should be beneficial because these chromosomes still have to pair. So the longer you have a region that they can pair, the better they can pair and segregate. So probably all these events took place under positive selection and antagonistic forces for the recombination. So now we have a Y chromosome that's left with very few genes that are male specific. They only go through the male. So we have a chromosome that has shrinked and has specialized. The X chromosome was believed to just have to undergo dosage compensation. If you think about females, they are now XX and the male are XY. So the X chromosome is only in one copy in the males. And the genes that were autosomal genes before were expressing at a level to work with the rest of the genome, the rest of the autosomal genes in the genome. Now they will be expressed at half of that if nothing changes for this X. So what believe occur in the mammal lineage is that this X began to overexpress. This X began to overexpress, and now females overexpress this X and inactivate one other one. So there is initial overexpression of the X chromosome to compensate, and then the females have to inactivate one to keep up with that. This is what is believed to have occurred. This is only recent data that we know the X is overexpressed because people thought, oh, the females inactivate, but you have to have this first overexpression of the X chromosome so that inactivation that doesn't leave you with just half of the amount. And females inactivate randomly gene. That's true in humans. In marsupials, the females inactivate the X chromosome that comes from the father.
There are no recessive genes on the X chromosome?
And that's a good question. The pressure, so the female is actually a chimera of hemizygote cells. The females are a mix of cells that inactivate this X or inactivate this X. So what the selective pressures are going to be for the females that do that, instead of expressing both X chromosomes, like in Drosophila, it's going to be different, definitely, because if you have some recessive disadvantageous allele can be purified
There are recessive genes in this.
But
so presumably those are not required in male.
No, yeah, what? Hemophilia is the X
recessive. Females are not so affected because they have Apache, but for some other things that if you end being having the wrong chromosome inactivated in a particular tissue, you may still suffer.
My statement is they're recessive, they're just not
lethal. You can do that. Colorblindness,
and those are going to be more evident in the male because the female is a chimera. But depending on the disease, the female can still suffer because it's inactivating one chromosome in a chimeric way, but in marsupials is inactivating the parental chromosome. So it's in fact hemizygote for all the tissues, the female. So the traditional view that I wanted to summarize in this slide is a little bit illustrated by this comparison with mouse. The X chromosomes seem to be, you know, containing the same genes that the human chromosome had. The Y chromosome looks like the Y chromosome in mouse or similar. The rest of chromosomes have had many rearrangements. So once you evolve a sex determining system, it's not easy, probably because of dosage compensation, just break that chromosome, put it, arrange it, rearrange it with other chromosomes. But what they are now are a Y chromosome that has degenerated and specialized, an X chromosome that undergoes dosage compensation, so female X inactivation and overexpression of the X, and then probably has a conserved gene content that has not rearranged with other chromosomes. And it was proposed that was the favorable location for male and female bias genes. And that's because in males, the X chromosome is a hemizygote. So for the recessive alleles that he was talking about, the males are gonna be able to select easier and bring those alleles, if are beneficial to the male, they are gonna bring them at high frequency easily. But then also people thought, yes, but female can bring at high frequency the alleles that are dominant because the X chromosome spends two-thirds of the time in females. So that means that you can, the female can increase in frequency dominant alleles.
Sort of a basic question, but going back to when you have sort of the two autosomes, one of which sort of gets a sort of male allele on it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to think about, is it obvious that the sort of being homozygous for the male allele is...
Oh, you are not...
Back in the past, is it obvious how... Because no one's homozygous for the Y.
No one is homozygous for the Y, yeah. Because the gene appears and is now a way of saying maleness, but you don't need two copies, so... That one is the one that will be passed, so it will never be homozygote for the SRY.
Right, I guess I'm thinking when they started out initially, and the X and the Y were very, very similar.
You still needed SOX3, and if you had just two Y chromosomes.
Okay, so it's sort of very sharp differentiation.
Esther, I don't rant. Mm-hmm. So in the ZW systems, is it simply that when in the origin of sex, mm-hmm. zygous individuals, heterozygous individuals are females, and so you went the other way?
The sex determination, you can have a gene that determines females, but I'm now, I think they are still after some of these details. But in Drosophila, we just have a counting system, so you don't really need a particular allele if you come up with a differentiation between chromosomes and a counting system. You can still end with the same, with the same pressures. Something like a null allele and a counting system for that null allele can lead to the same pressures. So, now is when I want to talk about duplications, and I want to focus on retroposition. Duplications, we might have whole genome duplications, or we might have some segmental duplications that might be big or small in tandem or not in tandem. But I want to focus on one particular mechanism that forms a gene that we can tell us a lot about patterns of duplication, and that's what we call retroposed gene. So one way genes can duplicate is if what we call a parental gene, in this case, is transcribed. So you have a pre-mRNA, so just the transcript of this gene is processed and goes out of the nucleus to be translated, but is picked up in the cytoplasm by the retrotranscriptase of what are called non-LTR elements. So in humans, the line type of elements, L1 type of element, and the retrotranscriptase is gonna recognize this polyadenylated transcript because its own transcript is also polyadenylated. So often mistakenly just grabs that transcript, brings it back to the nucleus, and in another random location, it just makes a nick and uses this this 3' end to prime the reverse transcription. So this we call target prime reverse transcription, TPRT, and then this inserts, and it looks like processed copy of a gene. So now lost all the introns.
What is gDNA? What is gDNA? Genomic DNA?
Where?
It's a nick gDNA.
Well, genomic. It's gonna nick the genomic DNA. And so it's back in the nucleus, this is what it means. It's back in the nucleus, and wherever finds a way of nicking, it's making this first cut and then retranscribing to insert this copy. And then you have either repair machinery or the same enzyme, that's not completely clear, make the second strand. And you end with a copy that we call retrotransposed gene or retrogene. And for a very long time, these genes were thought to be pseudogenes, because they don't carry regulatory regions. They are very abundant in humans, the same that we have a lot of line insertions. This machinery helped to make many of these types of insertions, and they were, for a very long time, they were just called processed pseudogenes. But now we know we have a big fraction that are functional. It doesn't need to be that you have a line element near there. Just in the cytoplasm, instead of grabbing the its own, usually the protein is translated and it's easier to grab its own transcript because it's right there, but sometimes mistakenly grabs other transcripts of that are around in the cytoplasm, brings it to the nucleus. So these proteins interact with the cellular machinery, have to have a way to come back to the nucleus, retranscribe and insert this gene in the nucleus. Oh, sorry, yeah. After the insertion, usually you don't have a blunt end break. You have what is called a staggered break. So there are the hanging regions that need to be repaired, and these are direct repeats, or what we call target site duplications, that are going to flank these insertions. These are means by how. I'm gonna, in the next slide, I have a list of the hallmarks. So the hallmarks of retroposition is now this gene, the parental has introns, exons, very clearly, but this gene is completely intronless. If it's very young, still the poly A you can see at the end, because part of it is gonna be retranscribed. And then it has these direct flanking repeats of the process of nicking, and it, since this nick doesn't leave a blunt end, it leaves a staggered end that needs to be repaired. You have these direct repeats or target site duplications flanking the insertion. So those are ways. Usually we guide ourselves through recognizing intronless genes because the other two features disappear very fast through mutations, so fixation of mutations.
Why would it necessarily be in Chandler's? Because you could insert it prior to the splicing.
You could, but we think the recognition happens already when the retrotranscriptase is in the cytoplasm and is already completely processed transcript. So, and it could still in the nucleus recognize another one that's halfway and you just lose part of the introns. That's possible. But to be safe, we usually focus on the ones that are not like partially processed but completely processed.
How many such things exist? So there's a fraction of, say, all orbs. What fraction would be the retro?
Retro copies. We have probably thousands of retro genes, and functional the order of the 100, something like that. And in Drosophila, on the order of 100 as well. But in Drosophila, there is a deletion bias, and we don't have pseudogenes to speak of. But in humans, we do have. When we do our analysis, we leave this middle ground without annotating. We go and say, these are pseudogenes, the ones that are really disabled, and then these are functional, the ones that look really functional and have constraint at the protein level. We can test if they are the protein evolving is lower than the synonymous sites. But the middle ground in which we see transcription and some disablements, but you still could get that protein quite long, but you know, those we just leave there.
So do we have many more of them than, say, other mammals?
About pseudogenes?
Well, in particular, these retro genes.
Retro elements. I think possum, for example, has many, so marsupials, dog, or the recent analysis, and I'll be talking a little bit about them. Many functional, but many non-functional. But for example, if you go to platypus, you don't have many left there. Probably, I think what I recently read is like 50 copies, considering disabled and non-disabled.
Is it easy to, or can one say something about the age distribution of them, or is that from this sequence analysis, can one see how old?
Yeah, so probably for the functional ones, that has been really well known. For the non-functional as well, it seems that they date to a burst at the same time that the line elements appear and burst in the genome, so there's been some dating. And most of the retroposition occur after a burst of line element machinery in the cells. But they, for our analysis, they have continued to occur and some of them be recruited to be functional. And I want to show you some data on those.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. Why would this not be strongly selected against? Because this is like insertional mutagenesis, right? You can imagine some oncogene which is put in front of a promoter.
Yeah, you have to think that for the human genome, we have only 1% or around 1% of the human genome is coding. You might think maybe another big fraction is regulatory, but 50% of the genome, human genome, is transposable element. So 50% of the human genome is already insertions. You have more insertions inserted into these insertions. I don't think you are bad off. Maybe you are even better off. You are knocking out some of these transposable elements if they were active. So I don't know. You can, you know, many of them are deleterious, like they are supposed to be the transposable element insertions deleterious, but some of them just get new functions. And
a regulatory mechanism that would reduce the incidence of such insertions.
Mm-hmm. For the transposable elements, definitely there are ways in which they are kept down. And through methylation or through RNA interference machinery, things like that, they are kept down for their mobilization. If that's kept down, this process is also kept down. So the bursts of line elements before they were just shut down at the levels they are now, there was more before than there is now, but still. So the important thing, like for any duplicated gene, the parental and derived genes are going to share sequence similarities, so that's how we find them. And they are going to have different locations, and that's going to give us the edge of trying to see the directions of transposition. As I was saying, the retrogene usually lacks regulatory regions at the time of the insertion. And we're still in the lab working on trying to describe the regulatory regions of these genes, but I will not be talking about that much. So what's important here, the way I describe the process, is that you have clear a parental gene that you can clearly define that has more than one exon, and we focus on the coding region. We don't analyze 5' or 3' UTR that also diverge quicker. So we focus on the coding region, and we focus on looking at if any other annotated gene in the genome is intronless compared with this one. And the best hit for a retrogene, we say that's the parental gene in the genome, because we know if there is an intron-containing gene in the genome for an intronless gene, it's not easy to claim that all the introns were lost at once, precisely, unless you claim this process. So that's the way we define. I'm going to talk mainly about the work we've done in fly and human. And we try to work on chicken that has, as we were commenting, different sex chromosomes, so maybe different patterns. But here, the retrotranscription machinery is very different. So they don't have the type of elements that flies or humans have. They have a type of element that recognizes not a polyadenylated transcript, but its own transcript, a sequence in its own transcript. So it's not gonna, by mistake, retrotranscribe other things. So when we did the work, there were not many retrogenes to speak of. So in Drosophila, we began this work a while back while I was at Manuel Long Lab, but recently we have updated, at least been able to date some of the events with the 12 sequence genome annotation. This was the cover of the journal Genetics when the analysis of the 12 Drosophila genomes was done. And it has served as a very good model system for this. So what we do, as I told you, is we look at a particular genome. In this case, the first sequence genome was Drosophila melanogaster. So we look at that genome and we say, we have an intronless gene whose best hit is a parental gene with introns. So we have a retrogene. So we claim this is younger. So at some point, this retroposition event occur, this duplicate originated. And doing that and not looking at the Y chromosome that was being analyzed separately, we found 94 events of retroposition. So not that many functional genes, and in fact, one or two pseudogenes to speak of. So very little pseudogene information in Drosophila. So with these 94 retroposition events, what we can do now with the 12 sequence genomes is, do we find them? You could also check sequence divergence to see how old they are, but what we did, we thought was more precise, we just went and checked, is this retrogene that we find present in what other species, so that we can date the retroposition event. And if it's absent in these others, we say this retrogene originated in this particular lineage. So through presence, absence, we decided for that. So only 32 of the 94 events are younger than 63 million years. So the rest are older. They are in these species that are, they are at least in one of these species. So we can say they are older than all the 12 genomes that were sequenced. But then these other ones are younger. So we came up with rate that is one gene every 2 million years. One retrogene every 2 million years, that's the rate. When you divide the number of genes by the number of million years, it's 0.5 genes per million years. And that seems to be sort of constant. We haven't tested, but in this node, you will calculate the same way, 0.4, 0.36, 0.4, 0.47. The only node that is very different is the one that's estimated, the rate is estimated only with one retrogene. So it seems to be ongoing and sort of a constant rate there. And it's sort of similar when we were talking about humans, that they have many retransposition events. The estimates from Marquez et al., another group, estimated after this burst of retroposition, they estimated that in the human limits we have one retrogene per million years. So it's not that far. But I have to remind you that in Drosophila, everything that we see there we think is functional. And here they had to be very strict of what they were calling functional, because there are so many copies. People just say, just look at the ones you can say they are really functional. And those are the things that are being annotated as functional genes. Probably some others are also functional. But the order of magnitude of functional retrogene production in these two lineages is not very different. I want to remind you that I'm talking about a small fraction of the duplicates that are going on. So retroposition is not the most common way of duplicating genes. It's only if you look at estimates of Han, you are getting in Drosophila 17 genes per million years. So retrogenes are only 3% of what's going on. But we are seeing things that will be more difficult to see, or we will need more data if we look at other types of genes. And it's, we already in 2002 revealed that many retroposition events occur from parents on the X chromosome that give rise to retrogenes on the autosomes. And that was focusing only on retrogenes that had parentals in a different chromosome. So we didn't look at all at retrogenes that had parental in the same chromosome. Let's see if now I told you about the genome has autosomes, has X chromosomes, and has Y chromosomes. So it's not a unique a single environment. There are like several environments where the genes can find themselves, and there is the, as I was saying, the autosomes are particular, the X chromosome emits zygote in males and spending a lot of time in females, and the Y chromosome. So let's see if we see any pattern. The revised analysis from 2007 tell us that 58 of the 94 retroposition events are between chromosomes. So 58 of the 94 are between chromosomes. Between what chromosomes? A retroposition event whose parent is on the X chromosome and duplicated to the autosomes, we have 30. That the parental gene was on the autosome and the retroposition event was on the X, we have 10. And autosome to autosome, and Drosophila has three other autosomes, one very small one, fourth chromosome, but it has the second and third chromosome are quite big. Those are both here, we have 18. And if you just calculate your expectation, thinking that if a chromosome has many genes, should produce more retrogenes, and if a chromosome is very big in euchromatin, should receive many more genes, if you calculate your expectation considering how many genes a chromosome has to donate and how big is the euchromatin to receive, you come up with these percentages. And these are the expectations in absolute number, and the results are very significant. So we have clearly a nexus from X to autosome export.
So you mentioned the X chromosome also evolves more slowly than other chromosomes. Is there a possibility that it's because it's easier to tell
parental genes and the X chromosomes and other chromosomes?
I don't think I understand your question. You're saying it was slower?
So in your analysis, you're trying to identify parental genes by looking at similarities with the
retro genes. Yeah.
Now, if it's possible, it's easier to tell them on the X chromosome because they evolve slower. They change less.
We don't think that's what's going on because we have many that are very old, and I think it's not that we cannot recognize them.
Okay. So the order of the X is staying more constant,
okay.
But the proteins themselves can evolve those different rates.
Yeah, they're faster.
It's probably the opposite, so that. Yeah. But we don't think that could be an explanation for this either.
You said that the machinery that inserts does so at random in the genome.
The way it inserts.
I think it's determined by GC content and things like that.
The ones that survive in humans are closer to genes, but maybe that's because it's easier to recruit expression. So the pseudo genes might be more random, but the ones that are functional are closer to genes, and the ones and express higher than the random expression of the
processes going on, one of which is the sort of mutational process.
I will try to separate these two things in the next slide for Drosophila. And for the data of humans, we have very good way of separating these two things because we look at retro pseudo genes and the patterns there and are very different. So I'll talk about this data. In Drosophila, the only thing we know is that we have a bias. Some genes, some of the functional genes are inserted in testis neighborhoods. There is an excess inserted in testis neighborhoods. So probably because it's open chromatin when they insert and it also helps them to stay functional. That's where, but that's not the way they recruit, probably not the only way they recruit. That gives them a hint, but when we look at their regulatory regions, we are doing it experimentally. They have to recruit testis-specific regulatory regions, and sometimes just 50 base pairs in front of the gene is enough. So the neighborhood might be an initial, might help you initially, but in the end, you have to recruit your own machinery.
Is there any correlation with the level of expression?
Definitely. One thing I forgot to mention that these questions are reminding me, this needs to happen in germline. So first thing you need to have the whatever gene is gonna retropose has to be expressed in germline. And then if it has a lot of transcript, there are more chances that you will be retroposed. And that's very clear for humans where we have these many pseudogenes. Ribosomal proteins, we have many, many retro pseudogenes for them. And this type of thing is there. Then other things that have been shown is that if you are soluble, so if you are a soluble protein, so something that doesn't go immediately to the ER, you don't have this peptide that signals, you have to go to the ER so that you can hang, the transcript can hang in the cytoplasm, you have more chances to be retroposed than if you are one of these genes that immediately is brought to the ER to be translated in a different way. So these things all have effect, level of transcription and germline expression of the transcripts. So in Drosophila, we don't have pseudogenes. Pseudogenes will be the retropseudogenes. So that will be the best way of looking at the mutational patterns. And is this just a mutational pattern? Even if we find them functional, they might just be there because the bias is already, to begin with, is there. The only thing that we have in Drosophila is that if the machinery has a bias, probably this bias will also be there for retrotransposable elements. And the data of Fontanilles et al. Says that when you analyze X versus autosomes, where are the retro elements inserted more often X or autosome, the correlation is negative. So you have a variable that says X is 1, autosomes are 2, is negative. So the X has more retroelements than the autosomes in Drosophila. And that's also true for humans. But for humans, I'll show you data on pseudogenes. That is just the best data. But in humans, also, a lot of line elements accumulate in the X chromosome. So somehow, in both species, the transposable elements accumulate in the X chromosome more than in the autosomes. So they analyze other variables to see if they could explain the transposable element distribution in chromatin. But for this talk, I think the only important one is X versus autosomes. So we think this bias is not mutational. So the other thing is that many of these retrogenes, and in addition, even more of the ones that are from X to autosomes, express in male germline. And a big fraction express uniquely in male germline. And this is the analysis we did, but using data, array data from Chintapalli's paper. Maybe some of you know of the Fly Atlas data. That is all adult tissues analyzed. Whole genome, there is only 7% of genes expressed uniquely in testes. But for retrogenes, it's 36%. So it's very different. They are, in general, testis biased. And for the ones that are exported as well, very testis biased and or uniquely expressed in testis.
Is there a measure of the native tissue they are lost? Because they could be lost as well once they're inserted, you could lose them.
We are trying to look at that. We see losses now that at the beginning we look only at the melanoaster genome and then we see what there is there and we just date it. But when we try to date, sometimes we can only tell for sure is in this species because we find it in one far related species, but some of the ones in the middle lost the gene. So we know they can be lost and that will come to the discussion. Because some of the hypotheses that have been circulating to explain why this exodus from the X is occurring seem to be that these genes that are created will be very necessary. And I will tell about the hypothesis, but the ones that we are thinking about are X inactivation in male germline or antagonism. Like the male needs this gene to do something different from what the female is doing, but needs this gene. And it seems that just getting a duplicate and just losing it doesn't make complete sense. The same for X inactivation, but we know there is loss, but haven't calculated the rates yet. We've seen losses, definitely. And that will come up part of the discussion later.
The species in which the Y gene, the analog of the SRY, got inserted and became functional, so that you have two parallel species, two kinds of males.
These are the things that are going on with sex chromosomes that are just striking, but this is happening. You have this SRY gene in a proto-Y chromosome and can move to another chromosome. Now the proto-Y chromosome is this other chromosome. So we are saying duplications can occur, right? So if this gene duplicates in a species where it has some structure, one population can have one proto-Y, another population can have another proto-Y, and this is happening. And in fact, I wanted to bring it up later because it was suggested for humans that, or for any Y chromosome, if it keeps degenerating, you are left with the sex-determining gene, and then what? Then some people thought, now this gene, if it moves somewhere else, you'll be in the whole thing again. And if that happens in different populations in different ways, you have a burst of speciation. And this was proposed by Jennifer Marshall Graves, and I want to show you the picture where she talked about that. But the Y chromosome has another story to that I'll tell you related to that. So human and mouse, we could do a better analysis because, as I said, we have a lot of retro pseudogenes. And any numbers that appear here are not all the retrocopies that we have in the genome, because we tried to put as functional the ones we could say they were functional for sure, using many means, like the open reading frame looked intact, was transcribed, and was showing constraint, so the protein looked like functional. The non-synonymous and synonymous sites were evolving in very different ways. But for retropseudogenes, if you didn't have transcript and your protein looked like probably under constraint, but some disabled, present disablements, we just didn't consider pseudogenes. So we, unless you had clear disablements, we don't put you in this category. So the numbers are smaller than they should be, but as I was saying, you have the 23 chromosomes here of humans in all these dots, and the X chromosome is encircled here. And it's just a linear relationship between how many genes are in that chromosome, how many pseudogenes are being produced, retropseudogenes. So for the X chromosome, we have very linear relationship, but not for the functional ones. The functional ones are on the top, and for the functional ones, the X is exporting a lot more. And again, in this case, I'm not gonna show the data on male germ bias expression, but recently we know that it's male germ line bias, and very likely, well, very likely, that it's clear that the parental gene stops expressing and the retrogene takes over during spermatogenesis. So the parental gene expresses early and then the retrogene expresses later. So these are the 95% prediction intervals. So seeing it outside, you are already testing that this is a significant result. So that's why I didn't bring any test here. The other thing that I wanted to tell you, and it's also shown in the next slide, but already in this paper we knew about it, is that it's an ongoing process. So we had some that were young and were shared, were not shared between mouse and human, and there were others that were old and were shared. You go to the synthetic region and are shared between mouse and human. And I'm not showing you the data for mouse, but the data for mouse look the same. So the most recent data on this work of retroposition events in mammals, and this is some other data that I wanted to get to when you asked me about mammals and retroposcopies, comes from Petrovsky et al. 2008. And what we know is that there are not many retropose genes to speak of in platypus. There are a lot going in opossum. And but out of the X export probably didn't begin until this point where you see a lot of retrogenes going out of the X. I don't know if you can see the arrows. The blue arrows are retrogenes that are produced from that chromosome. So from here on, you have genes that are produced from the X chromosome, and it's an ongoing process in all these lineages. And you have to think that you have X and autosomes, but the X is just 1 out of 23, so it is already significant. These values are significant. The expectations are here in the small. So it's an ongoing. What they say in this paper, and was in agreement with something that was written about platypus before, is that now there is a new date for the X chromosomes, and it seems that the process I told you about, the differentiation, in which recombination is inhibited, and now the Y begins to degenerate, now the export might begin of these genes, occurred around 180 million years ago. So from there on, the export began. And not in this paper, but in another recent paper, just they describe that it really coincides with the four strata I told you about. So the more recent retrogenes are of the fourth strata, and you go backwards, and the older are of the first strata. So the export began and coincides with the strata and with the time where chromosomes seem to be really differentiated. So the process coincides with the differentiation of the sex chromosomes, and these genes that are being exported are male bias. So the data that I presented you up to here changes a little bit the previous beliefs in the sense that the X is now more dynamic than it was believed. And it seems that if you have retrogenes, there will be this pattern for all the things we have analyzed. If you have genes that go retro, and I'm using the words of a science writer that wrote about this work, blog this work in the New York Times, that if the genes go retro, you will see this pattern. We haven't seen it in chicken, but the genes haven't gone retro there. And so, and then this is the against the other traditional view that many male bias genes should be on the X chromosome. So these are two things that this kind of line of work.
What was the argument, the traditional argument, that male bias genes should be on the X chromosome?
Because the X chromosome is a mizygote. If you have these sexual antagonistic genes where both sexes are using them but want them for different things, and there are alleles that are better for male but worse for females, and alleles that are better for females but worse for males, if those mutations are recessive, the male is going to bring them at high frequency. And then it was proposed that once they are at high frequency, it will be interesting that modifiers of expression evolve to just make that male bias gene. So in the cases where these mutations are recessive, the male will increase these alleles in frequency, and it will be probable that male bias expression evolves, so modifiers of expression. But I'll tell you about some of these genes are essential genes, are very important genes, so it's not easy that. So we think duplication is a way of getting this sex bias expression. Once you brought this allele at high frequency, if you duplicate that make a male bias gene, then you are. So it's a way of relieving that sexual antagonism duplication. But the traditional way was that modifiers will evolve. It was not clear how that happens, but it was there.
I would have thought that precisely if it's the matter of modifiers, then these genes can be on other something. Why do they have to be
The male can select for these genes easier if they are on the X chromosome, just because if the mutations are recessive, they can be incorporated and increase in frequency. Fixation is going to be difficult because the female begins to see the homozygote. So at the fixation step, it might be difficult, but bringing it at high frequency was what was proposed. But we have to think that duplicates are mainly, I'm thinking, dominant things. You duplicate and you begin to be there in male germline, and that's not recessive, that's dominant. Even if you have a copy, that just began to be there. So I think even for new duplicates, it's easier for them. They are dominant effects, so the female is going to see them very early on, even if you duplicate them in the X chromosome. So that can also be there.
Is there a difference between expression of X chromosome genes and in oogenesis compared to spermatogenesis, do you know?
Yeah. Probably we need to, later I'll talk about that, but in mammals during spermatogenesis, the X at the beginning So in a spermatogonia, before you enter meiosis, a lot of X genes are expressed, then it's inactivated, something that's different from the X inactivation that the female undergoes to dosage compensate. This is called male germline X inactivation, and it seems that's done for the pairing of the X and Y chromosome. They cannot pair, so but they can, they have to stay together. So they sort of pair in the pseudo-autosomal region, but the rest of the chromatin condenses in what's called XY body, and that's the way they stay heterochromatized during meiosis, but then there is post-meiosis expression of X genes again. So whenever pairing is not important, and these chromosomes that are very different morphologically, and they cannot pair you, because if you don't pair, you are going to interfere with the pairing, with the other pairing chromosomes, and you might trigger apoptosis of that cell. If you are just an unpaired chromosome there, that's recognized and triggers apoptosis. So the mechanism is just condense whatever is not paired, and that's what the X undergoes, condensation, and probably cannot express those genes. But later, postmeiotically, can express more genes.
So this could be an explanation for the additional transport of these things from the X.
Yeah, we'll get there, but one of the hypotheses is X inactivation in male germline. But in Drosophila, even non-germline genes are located on the autosomes, biased to being on the autosomes. So then people have been thinking there are additional things. It's not only germline processes, it's more things, maybe antagonism with the female, because the female see the X two-thirds of the time, then maybe the male has the genes on the autosomes. So probably every species has its own.
And is it known in early embryogenesis when germline gets established?
Yeah, it's very early. It's very early in embryogenesis where the cells that are going to be germline cells are established, and those cells are very different from others. They keep, they have telomerase function, and they are very healthy in that sense, and they are different, and they are going to be kept apart, and those are the ones that are going to give rise to the gametes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So a little bit of that will be coming, and we can discuss more. So that's the first hypothesis that we already introduced. And that's the hypothesis that we proposed when we saw the Drosophila bias initially, because there were already some examples in mammals in which one of them I can tell you about was described by Mike Carey, and then the gene is called PGK, the parental is called PGK1, the retrogene is called PGK2, and the parental expresses early in germline in males, and then it stops, and then the retrogene takes over, and they correlated this, and this is the, McCarrey is the person that also saw the XY body and reported X inactivation in mouse, and studied how that occurs. So we knew about that, and we proposed that probably in Drosophila is the same. And there was some data that in Drosophila probably X inactivation also occurred, but we are still after the final answer for that. So this will mean that you have an X chromosome that's inactive at some point in spermatogenesis, and I can show you the picture of how the XY body looks like. And this is early in meiosis. The rest of the chromosomes are pairing, and here what you are staining is for transcription, so the autosomes are darker, and in here you are staining for heterochromatin, so the XY body is darker. And so it's believed to take place to protect unpaired chromosomes, or maybe to suppress recombination that was suggested. But then if that's occurring, and as I show you, the other chromosomes are still transcribed, because when you stain for transcription, the autosomes are still transcribed. If you need the gene all the time, you can do two things. You can express it very highly early on, and give to the transcript a lot of stability. But maybe that's a lot of work that you are doing if you have this same gene in the autosome instead of on the X chromosome. You just express it. So to avoid silencing during that period, maybe that's the reason some of the duplicates are beneficial and we see these bias. And many of the genes we see in mammals and also in Drosophila are essential genes. And this avoidance could be providing an advantage. We still think that this applies more directly to mammals because of all the correlation and the fact that a lot of the genes are under a lot of purifying selection. Because the other thing is, if this is true, we have some predictions, right? We have probably intense selection for essential genes, and then the pressure is on from very early on. But if you already got a way of coping with this, maybe putting the gene in an autosome might be better or might not be better. So the pressure, selective advantage can still be there, but probably much higher early on. But definitely higher for essential genes. If this is going on, this is like, I need this gene in this period and this period. This period, I do it this way. This other period, I do it with this other gene. So it's a sort of partitioning the function. The way I see it is a sort of partitioning the function. And definitely, the protein should be in a strong purifying selection. You need this for the same role. You just cannot express the X copy, but you need the same protein. So the protein should still be under a lot of purifying selection. And then all the genes should be expressed during X inactivation. So we are seeing this sort of thing in mammals, as I was telling you, that in spermatogonia, the X is highly expressed. And some people even thought about what I was telling you. Maybe some of these genes are needed later, but it's going to inactivate. So let's just express them highly so that we have the proteins there for later. But then in meiosis, it's inactivated together with the in this XY body. But then when you in postmeiotic stage, the X come back. In principle, you could have spermatids that have different content because some of them have already X, some of them have a Y, but they are communicated. So usually you have the same content in both of them. But this X inactivation correlates really well with what's going on in mammals. So probably this is what we think can be the explaining the exodus or export of these retrogenes in mammals. In Drosophila, there could be that, but other things probably need to be added. And even for humans, we need to check if all of the retrogenes fit that model of strong purifying selection and all that, because some of them might not. And the hypothesis of sexual antagonism came because there was data already in 2003, but now even more data when the genomes of Drosophila were published, that there is bias on the location of many germline genes to be on the autosomes, but also of the somatic genes to be on the autosomes. I already talked to you about, do you want to have a break now, or?
Yeah, it's definitely a good time for a break, if this is a good time.
Yeah, we leave the sexual antagonism, you told me maybe 11:15, but it's a little,
Okay, good, yeah, 10 or 15 minutes.
Yeah, we come back to this.
Same
We were talking about the sexual antagonistic hypothesis, and what we were saying is that this was proposed for Drosophila because we talk about what a sexual antagonistic gene is. A gene can have, being the same gene, can have different alleles shown here in different colors, yellow and green. But whenever that variation is related to how that gene affects males and females, it could be one gene that's good for females but hurts males, that we call a sexual antagonistic gene. And if it's on the X chromosome, the female is going to see these sexual antagonistic alleles more, and is going to be able to select for them more often. So bringing this pink allele at high frequency and the blue allele at low frequency, so the male doesn't have a lot of chances to increase in frequency the things that are beneficial in this case for the male. So that could be a pressure to have the male bias gene on the autosomes. And there should be instant selection for antagonistic genes. This is something. And we know there is a lot of antagonism going on the X chromosome, precisely because both male and female can select for different alleles better, males for recessive, females for dominant. So there is a lot of antagonistic variation on the X chromosome. And that is not clear if it's a sort of sub-functionalization, but we are seeing this gene the males want for something and cannot exactly do it because the female is also selecting for it. So you can think about it as a sort of specialization after duplication. So probably this gene should not be exactly keeping the original function, so they can change the function. But I think you don't really expect the gene to go and being completely different or being lost. So I don't think under these people are thinking that something that the male needs but needs to be a little different can be duplicated on an autosome and specialized, but still will not keep your exact original function but shouldn't be lost. That's what the view I'm taking of this hypothesis. And let me know if you think otherwise. So the X now should be a disfavored location, not only for male germline genes, but also for autosomal genes, if the female sees it at some point. So accessory gland genes or brain genes that are male biased should also be located in the autosomes. And that's what we see for Drosophila. When you look at expression in arrays, in blue the male bias genes and in pink the female bias genes, there is a lack of male bias genes on the X chromosome, and there was an excess on the female in this data on the X chromosome. But the most important thing that pointed people to think about sexual antagonism and not only a germline explanation was this data, that you see the same when you have genes that are not male germline genes. So when you look at SOMA array data, where are the male bias genes in the genome for things that are, when you analyze removing the germline, you do arrays removing the germline, you have male bias genes that could be brain or accessory glands that are still less represented on the X chromosome. So they said that the X chromosome is the masculinizing, and that's the support for this antagonistic hypothesis, why it was proposed. So it should be for germline, but also somatic gene expression. And the new data, again, supports that. There is an excess of male bias genes compared to female bias genes. There is a hard birth rate of extinction. So there are additional things going on there and higher divergence. But the autosomal location and the masculinization is not only in the data that I just showed you was Drosophila melanogaster. It's not only Drosophila melanogaster. When you study other lineages in this work of 2007 of the 12 genome sequence, they study four species for male bias genes, and they show that really there is a demasculinization, and you would expect 34 to 43% less bias genes, male bias genes, than what you see. So that is what people had in mind when they proposed sexual antagonism as an explanation. There has been a translocation from one autosome to the X chromosome in Drosophila pseudoscura that occurred 12 million years ago, and that has been enough time to come up with the same exact pattern. So that translocated X chromosome is also devoid of male bias genes compared to the rest of the genome, and has acquired different patterns of repeats and many other things. So there has been a lot of things that have been going on with that chromosome, but also the exodus or birth of genes that are male bias in the autosome, but not in this chromosome. So now I want to take a detour to tell you a little bit about meiotic drive. And this is because some people had suggested that maybe these retrogenes are involved in new functions, and in particular one new function that is one of these genomic conflicts that is called meiotic drive. And that was proposed because one of our retrogenes is involved in nuclear transport, and I will tell you some meiotic drive system might nuclear transport to the nucleus, or transport to the nucleus might affect these systems. But the whole story, that's why I'm telling you, is a detour, for us begins when we look at particular retrogenes in other lineages, and we see recurrent retroduplication of the same two genes that interact with each other. So we had this CRIVE a while back, was one of the retrogenes that we studied the most, the Drosophila nuclear transport factor 2. That's the parental gene, had duplicated, and three times when we look at other species has retroduplicated in Grimshauer and in the Drosophila melanosimulans and Seychellia. And RAN, that I will show you a slide, interacts directly with this gene, also has retroduplicates overlapping lineages. So the probability of that, if you just think that the retroduplication occurs just 0.5 per million years, that the same gene and the same interacting gene retroduplicates is very low. Out of the 14,000 genes in the genome.
So they're definitely separate events, so they're in different
retrogenes. They are in different locations, they have different age. One of them looks older than what we claim, but we still never find it in the other species, so we still just might be in a hot spot for mutation or something. This is what we think. It's one in Ananase that looks older. The rest fit, KS fits quite nicely with the age that we assign from presence absence. And these were named, this was known before, the retrogene in Drosophila melanogaster subgroup, RAN-like, was named before, but DNTF2R, we call it DNTF2R related, so a retrogene. And what we know is that, what I was telling you, is that these genes participate in nuclear transport and interact with each other. So that began to make us think, and they are all X2 autosome. So it could be, there is a definitely, we infer a strong selective pressure, but it could be X inactivation, or it could be antagonism. But the way I presented it to you is, what do you expect if it's an X inactivation? You expect a lot of purifying selection, and you expect the gene to keep the same function. And for antagonism, you expect a different gene, but maybe not a so different gene, and you don't expect losses. That's my thinking. So we can discuss if you don't think the same way. We now think that probably they are involved in this other type of a new function that involves probably a conflict, and I'll let you.
Gene exports out the X chromosome. Does the X chromosome gene retain its function as well?
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah. So these guys we are talking about, NTF2 in brown is a dimer protein. RAN is the green piece that can be bound to GDP, or in the nucleus can be bound to GTP. These are nuclear transport factors that we need in every cell. So the parental gene function that I'm showing here is in every cell, and they are needed because the role they play is NTF2 transports RAN from the cytoplasm to the nucleus so that it can become RAN GTP, and RAN GTP is needed to release the what we call cargo proteins. Those are proteins that have nuclear localization signal. And this signal is recognized in the cytoplasm by importing alpha here in blue, and importing alpha and beta allow this transport of these proteins to the nucleus. So the gradient of RAN GDP, RAN GTP is necessary in every cell so that you have GTP in the nucleus and allows releasing of the cargo protein in the nucleus. So this is very important. So the parental gene skip function.
The way you detect retro gene, you wouldn't find cases where the parent has been lost because you use the parent to find the retro gene.
Oh, yeah, that's true. It's true. We always assign the retro gene to a parental, thinking that the best hit of the retro gene is the parental gene. But if the gene that we are looking at just duplicated and that gene made a retro gene and got lost, then we are left with no...
There's another explanation for the export of these retro genes on X chromosomes might be that when the X is silenced in females, there are some genes that like to retain the original function of higher transcription of this gene, and it can't be done on the X, so it has to go somewhere else. There could be a strong selection pressure for that.
Mm.
If it becomes an essential gene in a pathway, it's moved out, because then you can have more that you wouldn't duplicate on the X itself. That might mess up the map.
Is there a notion that the retro genes can reacquire introns? By definition, the ones you can find them without.
These we wouldn't see them, because if it's in the coding region, we wouldn't consider them in the phase place. But intron gain is possible. But in some lineages, intron loss and gain is more happen more often than in others. In Drosophila, it's not that we are losing introns so often. So.
Okay, but intron gain is very rare, isn't it, right?
Yeah, I think in general it's rare, but.
Well-documented
cases. Hmm. But there are some examples of introns that are newly originated.
I'm sorry, I don't quite understand the answer. I asked this because of the previous question, that you wouldn't find a retro gene if it weren't for the parent.
Yeah.
That was also present. But if the answer to this intron question, if I understand correctly, then all the ORFs without introns become sort of candidate retrogene, no?
If they have a parent with introns in the genome, because we assume, like Marty was saying, that intron gain is not occurring that often. There are examples, but it's not something that occurs that often. And also you can always look at how the parent looks like in all the species, and the introns are in the same orthologous positions. So you can say this intron is not just something that was gained in this lineage. So you see the parent looking exactly the same, and the retrogene being something. So sometimes we have clear cases in which what we assign as parent is very clear, the same structure all through the 12 genomes, and just one retrogene originated that is young. So sometimes
the retro those genes don't carry a regulatory region of the parental gene with them. So the chance that it can actually replace the parental gene function and the parental gene gets lost
is small. There is one case I know in Drosophila. It's called I2. And what is now male bias is the parental gene. And the retro gene is broadly expressed. I only know that.
There are more.
So
how many genes you have that do not have influence and you do not find the
pattern? There is a fraction of just families that are all intronless, or a fraction of families that if we cannot trace easily to a parental gene, like there are so many intronless genes that hit each other and we don't know who's parental of who. If we can say who's parental of who because they are tandem, two intronless in tandem, they hit each other, but the best hit is a parental, the same parental gene, then we can assign that as an event of retroposition, then a tandem duplication. But if you have retrogenes that hit each other that are in different places in the genome, or intronless genes, I mean, that hit each other in different places in the genome, they could be retropositions or transpositions of themselves, and we cannot assign parental, we don't do it. So there is a big fraction of that.
Criteria like this poly A thing in the dangling region, are you always...
That doesn't remain for very long in Drosophila. Oh, so no. Only for the young genes we see it clearly. Yeah, the clearest example is one pseudogene in Drosophila. In humans it remains for a little longer. So
the candidates are just determined by no intron and...
In the end, yes, even we have these other features that we know accompany them, but... Yeah. Sometimes we can see a little bit of the UTR extending, so of the young ones, but...
They acquire regulatory region by themselves? How does that happen?
This is what we think. They acquire regulatory regions. For a fraction of the young ones, we are doing experiments. So we are putting that regulatory region in front of a reporter protein, and we are narrowing it down. And for testis expression, it's just very short regions that are needed. So sometimes 20 base pairs. We knew of that because the ones that have been described for testis bias expression are 14 base pairs. So just that is enough for testis expression. So this case that we just encounter of recurrent reproduplication of these genes is a case in which something that doesn't completely fit either X inactivation or antagonism we think is happening, because one of the genes run like in yellow here. This yellow gene is not in Yakuba. So it's lost. It's one of these losses we were talking about. If it's really needed for X inactivation, it shouldn't be lost. And if the male really needed to do something with this gene, it shouldn't be lost. So why is it lost? Or why is it evolving so fast? These are the KKS ratio, so how fast these genes are evolving. And if you do a McDonald-Creyman test on both, not on all of them, we have data, only for this one, and this one is significantly more non-synonymous substitutions than non-synonymous segregating. The ratio is higher. So we think they are under positive selection. And you have to think that the parental genes are under a lot of constraint. So RAN, KEKS is 0.004. And I'll show you one slide in which I compare the parental and the retro gene. So that's what I mean about this gene is something that we don't expect to happen if X inactivation of sexual antagonism are the explanation. Although this is a lot of in this alignment, I can tell you this is human, dog, and these are the Drosophila RAN parental genes. And these are the retroposed copies. And RAN, I have to remind you, is that green protein that that interacts with importin beta, interacts with DNTF2, but also interacts with RAN gap to interacts with RAN gap so that it can be transformed from RAN GTP form to RAN GDP form, and interacts with RCC1 and interacts with exporting when export occurs. So it has many, many interactions. And if you look at them, we have boxed them or colored them here. And I'm just going to go through one case, but I can point you to other cases. This is this part of the alignment, and is the interaction with beta importing. So this is the interaction that would release the cargo. And while human, dog, and all the other run likes have all these residues, these are 8 residues that are exactly the same, haven't changed from human. Now the run like for the 4 species we have it, I told you one is a pseudogene, then it's very different. So it's losing functions. It's just not, it's not that the male is using this exact protein for a different thing or during X inactivation. It's just completely doing a different function. And it does, that's true for this region. It's true for this region. I don't know if you can see a insertion here and quite a few changes. When we have tried, and we are also using other models, but when we have tried PAML to see if we can see if there are selected sites, branch site models to see if there are selected sites, some of them coincide. So we think what is really clear is it still interacts with DNTF2R, and we're still exploring the other interactions, but many of them are being lost. Of the interactions of this protein. And we have to think that this is a very important protein for transport, so we don't think the male is using this protein for the same thing during X inactivation. And then is when we, I want to bring the hypothesis that was put forward by Pes Graves, and is that many of the duplicates that have nuclear transport could be involved in a what is called meiotic drive conflict. So usually the chromosome that you inherit from your mother, here in red, and the chromosome that you inherit from your father during gametogenesis should produce the same number of gametes, so that a male ends producing 2 blue gametes and 2 red gametes for every cell that undergoes meiosis, and that's just what brings along the Mendelian inheritance. But if meiotic drive occurs, sometimes what we know is that some chromosomes carry something that prevents the way we think, and I will tell you a little bit about the system. This chromosome carries something that prevents this other one from being passed along. Or something happens when these 2 chromosomes are together that prevents this other chromosome to be passed along. We call that meiotic drive. This chromosome is going to be passed most of the times to the next generation. And now Mendelian inheritance is not at play. Only one chromosome is going to be the one that passes most of the time. There is this SD system, well known in Drosophila, and I have to tell you, it's very young. So this cannot be the explanation for our retrogenes, but it could be that many systems work in a similar way or using similar features, so that it could explain why these retrogenes are evolving so fast and are needed at some points only for a few functions, but not for others, and are later just discarded. And we are still exploring this data, so it could be that they are good for other novel functions, but we now have this hypothesis that probably is meiotic drive. So these are the meiotic drive system that I show here has been well worked out for many years, and it will be a long list, and this is just a review paper. But this SD system carries this SD locus, that is the segregation distortion locus. If you carry that together with what they call a responder insensitive locus, that is a satellite, is a short repeat, and then this is going to be driven 99% of the time to the progeny, and the other chromosome that carries the wild type of the SD and has a responder locus that's a longer satellite is not going to make it to the next generation. So The PESGRACE proposed that DNTF2R was involved in this system for several reasons. First, it maps here, and you will see that the SD gene is a nuclear transport factor related gene. So he thought linkage, because linkage is important usually in this system, that the driver with the responder all together, anything that's linked to that could be playing a role. The SD gene is a duplication of the RAN gap gene. And I know there is a lot of RAN genes here. The RAN gap is the one that is in the cytoplasm that converts RAN GTP to RAN GDP. So if you want, I can go back to this slide. So is this gene in gray here? This is the gene that when duplicated, and if the duplicate is truncated, interferes with the segregation of the chromosomes. Hmm? And it's different from RAN, that's the green molecule. So, in fact, the SD system is, as I was saying, the RAN is there, the original needed RAN gene, but in germline you have the expression of this SD gene that is a duplication of that, but doesn't have the whole gene, has only this first four exons and doesn't have the second two. So what happens is it doesn't have a cytoplasmic localization signal. So doesn't exit to the cytoplasm, doesn't stay so much in the cytoplasm. It's in the nucleus. And then you have this one that has the catalytic activity just converting RAN GTP into RAN GDP in the nucleus. So now the gradient and the transport is perturbed because of having this protein that should be converting RAN GTP into RAN GDP in the cytoplasm, but now is in the nucleus. And the gradient of RAN GTP in the cytoplasm, nucleus and GDP in the cytoplasm is perturbed. There are two hypotheses out there of how these things work, and they really haven't seen support for this one, in which RAN gap that is now in the nucleus explains everything because binds to the responder satellite and doesn't allow it to condense or something. If you don't condense, you are going to properly segregate if you have a good centromere, but you are not going to make it into the sperm. Okay, then that's why this chromosome doesn't mature. But this has never been seen, RAN gap binding to the responder or anything like that. So what the PESGRACE, and he didn't think about this model, but he thought there is something to do with transport, and anything that that can modify transport and the gradient of RAN GDP, RAN GDP might be suppressors of the drive or drivers themselves. And you have to think that usually this chromosome that's being driven might not be the best chromosome in the population. So it's normal that if suppressors of this drive appear, they are going to increase in frequency, because this might not be, it might recombine into being the best chromosome, but at the beginning might not be the best chromosome in the population. So suppressors of the drive might evolve, and you have these selfish elements that drive themselves and with these other genes that are appearing often through duplication that try to suppress these selfish genes. And what was proposed is that maybe what's going on with this satellite is that condensation occurs through somehow RNA interference mechanism. And what happens is that transport is very important because you have to transport the interference RNAs to the nucleus so that you can condense this satellite. And maybe the longer you have the satellite, the more interference you need or something like that could explain it. So then transport and many other genes related to transport could affect and compensate for that. This brings the case to the, well, this brings me to say that if many meiotic drive systems are related to interference, the transport of these interference RNAs might be what affects the nuclear transport genes. And if many work like that, then that gives us a hint of how the nuclear transports that we are, genes that we are talking about, could be recruited in the first place. Because the system I'm just talking about is very young. So we will assume that these type of things are sort of ongoing for several meiotic drive systems, not only for this one, and are related to transport. So what we are trying to do is gather data. What happens if we knock out this gene? When is it expressed? All that. And it is expressed late in spermatogenesis. We are trying to see when the parental is expressed, when we see the protein. And we don't have that data on the protein yet. But for example, for DNTF2R, we have a knockout line that has no obvious fertility effects. So if it was X inactivation, and you remove it, you expect infertility because now you don't have this gene and you don't have the parental replacing it either. And then you should expect fertility effects, but we don't have obvious fertility effects. We are doing some particular fine assays now, but the knockout line is for now fine. So we are trying to see if Pesgrave's is right and this gene that's in the same chromosome of the SD system does something. So what we put is a SD line, SD5, against a chromosome that has this knockout for DNTF2R. So that brings only down the expression because DNTF2R is still in the SD5 line. So we just remove a dose of DNTF2R and we see that how often this chromosome or this chromosome, this one has a P element insertion that leads to orange eyes. So we can follow it, how is it segregating. Usually SD5 will lead to a distortion of 0.99, as I commented before. But when we knock out this, knock down this gene, it leads to a 0.77. And that's our essay on fertility. We don't have a lot of ion viability of this chromosome. We don't have a lot of data, but it's just not different from 50%, 50%. So probably when you knock down this gene, it affects drive, as some of the nuclear transport genes have been shown to affect. So now the third hypothesis will be often these genes are recruited for new functions, and let's see how often they are recruited for some roles like meiotic drive roles and see if some of these, at least the ones that we see recurrently, have been drivers or suppressors of these conflicts. And I sometimes like to think that it could be there could be an interplay between sexual antagonism as well, because this chromosome in the male is being driven if it recombines to be the best chromosome of the male. It could probably be good to fix it. So.
Can I ask about the model you're imagining? Mm-hmm. So in all these species, you see both MTF2-like genes and RAN-like genes.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the varieties is this. Distorter.
No, yeah. I'm thinking always when they arise are suppressors.
But both of these are types of suppressors.
I think when they arise, yes, but then later they change quite fast. And when they are there as an additional copy, changes can occur to have an allele that is more of a driver. And which one is going to fix depends on its location in the genome and if it's close to a driver system or. So I'm thinking when they first duplicate, if you go back to the slide, when these genes first duplicate, you have extra dose of RAN. So it's going to be imported more into the nucleus and more transformed to GTP. So probably you are going to equilibrate the gradient. And DNTF2, an additional copy, is going to do the same, bring more RAN GTP to the nucleus. And in the nucleus will be more transformed to RAN GTP and equilibrate the gradient. So probably an additional dose of any of these genes is going to first be a suppressor of any drive that's messing up the gradient. But how that plays later, it depends where they are located and if any drive system appears, and they might just begin to evolve fast.
Does that explain why they first appear one after another? Because it could be that just having one is enough to suppress the drive. You're saying you always need
both. I'm thinking that, yeah, we see that they both duplicate in the same lineages or overlapping lineages. And maybe it's because they being as a suppressor, right? But then there are alleles that may get involved into now being drivers. And then the other one is now going to play the role of suppressing this one. But we don't have any reconstruction of what the alleles were, and we're still understanding these proteins we have. Why I could put all the functions there is because they are crystallized and we know a lot. So if we reconstruct some of how the protein looked like before, but our first thought is whichever duplicates first is gonna probably, if it's all gradient distortion, is gonna suppress. And then might change into being a driver later, depending on the location or some alleles.
I mean, it could be possible that it arises and starts an uptake drive.
And then you
retrotranspose and it somehow gets a new function which starts an uptake drive system, and then you have to retrotranspose another.
If the retrotranspose copy is one allele that already doesn't bind really well, of RAN that doesn't bind really well to DNTF2, yeah, if the retropose RAN, it could begin as a driver because if you retropose and you bind to DNTF2 but not really well, you are preventing it from entering the nucleus, you are messing up the gradient. So that could also be, but we think when it happened, well, there has to be already variation for the parental alleles, and usually for RAN, there's very much constraint. So probably, in some cases, RAN is the first one to be duplicated. So to me, is any retrogene of RAN will look very similar to RAN, but maybe there is one allele at some point that is different and begins as being a driver, could be. So we don't know for sure. But if you think they are identical to the parental gene, they will be usually suppressors of this kind of system. But if there are already alleles segregating at low frequency that are different, they could be drivers.
I'm lost as to what's so special about this particular interacting pair.
The whole thing is there is an another thing that happens in meiosis that is just not produced the best sperm, and it's this conflict, and this is also happening in female meiosis and in male meiosis.
Okay, so this just happens to be a convenient example.
No, it's like some of these duplicate genes. We are thinking about they are just making better sperm or better spermatogenesis, but we know, and this I don't present all the data, but we know these other selfish systems occur that are driving some chromosomes selfishly up in frequency in the population, and that can only be done in meiosis. So in meiosis there are these other things happening. And it was just, we didn't think about that at the beginning, but it was just proposed that one of the systems works with a nuclear transport gene being a major player. Then if you look at that and see how often some nuclear transport factor genes retropose and express in male germline, you're wondering if at all some of them might be not just making spermatogenesis better, but trying, or making it better in the sense that they try to prevent this meiotic drive system from increasing in frequency. So I'm just introducing another thing completely different. I've been telling you about X inactivation and male-female conflict, but there is this other thing that happens in meiosis, in germline, that there are drivers that can selfishly increase in frequency some chromosomes that might not be the best in the population. So the organisms might be evolving suppressors, often through duplication, and some of the retrogenes might be the way. There is another system. There is another system that also goes through RNA interference and involves a retrogene. So the driver is a duplication, and the suppressor is a retransposed copy, but now it's a non-functional one. It's producing antisense, and it's not even, it's an RNA gene that's producing an antisense, and it's not even coding, but it's enough to suppress the driver because it can generate antisense, and silence the driver with that machinery. So in that situation, again, as siRNA machinery or small RNAs will play a role. So that begins to tie up with other systems. That's why I'm saying this system is very young, because grave things originated in Africa like 100,000 years ago, so very recent. And these genes are millions of years old, but from their origin and still might be involved in these type of things. But it could be X inactivation as well. But, you know, we probably need to keep this in mind and separate what cases fit to what. And some of these might be, because with X inactivation or antagonism, I don't think you expect gene losses. But if a drive disappears, like fixes, or there is no drive anymore in that lineage, you don't need that gene and it can pseudogenize. So that's one easier way to explain pseudogenization, that they have a different function. That's not X inactivation or antagonism, but a different one. And one of them that is being suggested is they play a role in meiotic drive. So it's just reminding us that in male germline and in female germline as well, there is another thing that happens, and maybe some of these genes are playing this role. And probably I'll take just 5 more minutes to tell you a little bit about the Y chromosome. Some of you might know already about this, but since I began talking about sex chromosomes and duplications, I thought, okay, let's bring the nice story of what we have going on with the Y chromosome. And it's that the Y chromosome is left with, it's degenerated and left with very few ancestral genes that are having male function, but we see some new genes. We have, for example, here are some examples. The diesel-like gene, we know transpose and give rise to a gene in the Y chromosome, a male specific gene, or CDL retrotranspose and give rise to a male specific gene now. So that's one side of duplication. But probably most amazing story comes related to things that we have been commenting before, and is that I think it was 2002 or let me see. By the way. Yeah, 2002, when Jennifer Marshall Graves wrote the paper that says the rise and fall of the Y chromosome, human Y chromosome. So the rise appears because there is the SRY, and then it degenerates, and the male has its own gene, can put the male genes there and do the best of what the male can do. But then it falls, and how it falls, it's degenerating. It doesn't recombine and it's degenerating. And she said it's losing genes at a very high rate. She's in Australia and works with sex chromosomes in marsupials. So the rate is like it's losing genes all the time. And she thought at some point, and that wouldn't be the first instance, some Drosophila species don't have Y chromosome, so you can lose the Y altogether sometimes. So she said, you will be left with the SRY gene that we were commenting before. You keep losing genes because you are not recombining and are degenerating. If you keep losing genes, you will be left with the SRY gene, and either you will go to extinction because we don't have males anymore if the SRY degenerate, or it duplicates, and again, it will involve duplication, or it duplicates somewhere else and begins a new proto-Y chromosome in different populations, a different proto-Y chromosome, or if we really are not so structured, then a single new sex-determining chromosome. And I guess what came after this was the sequencing of the Y chromosome, and the people began to rethink that the Y chromosome was not really rotting. And of course, it was a male that came to the rescue here, David Page, saying, no, the Y chromosome is not rotting. We have sequencing it. We have sequenced it. It took very long time. And Willard, in one commentary, said, presented a big challenge, but now the secrets justify the effort. And it's because what there are just duplicated genes. We find many of the genes we thought were there, now we find them duplicated. And duplicated in a very particular arranged way. And these are palindromes. This gene is also here, but tail to tail. So, and if you look at this, the arrows try to represent the same gene, but a different copy. And there are many that are arranged this way, and that several in one after the other that are arranged that way. And they didn't know what to make of that. But then it comes to us as an incredible surprise that what's going on is that you have two copies that can gene convert each other and can rescue the allele that's beneficial or that's still healthy, can rescue the other one. The other thing can happen as well, the gene that degenerated can gene convert into both being degenerated. But once you make two healthy copies, you are better off than if you had only one healthy copy. And it's not only that we know that, we have data. And how do we have data? They went to chimp. And if it's a gene that is in, if it's a duplicate that is more ancient than the human chimp split, every ortholog of human and chimp should be in the phylogeny closer to each other. And the paralogous copy of human and chimp should be closer to each other. What they found is that the two copies in human are very similar and very different from the two copies in chimp. And that can only explain by gene conversion. So you initiate recombination, but you don't end recombining. You have this heteroduplex being formed that will need to be repaired. And if you repair to the non-degenerated copy, you now have two healthy copies. And that's what is probably keeping the Y chromosome from rotting in some of the genes. And I think I could leave it here. Just I'll go and tell you that I always thought that the sex chromosome was really a very big makeover of the genome, and that I told you about duplication, that's only one point in that makeover, but you have, I mentioned whole chromosome dosage compensation, degeneration and specialization, you have the effects of lack of recombination, you have reorganizations, inversion, translocations, accumulation of transposable elements that I didn't talk about, and many of these things are under positive selection. So there's a huge amount of positive selection. We know that when you enter that road, you're just gonna end with these degenerated chromosomes. So there is something driving, probably mostly sexual antagonism driving that, but it's a complete makeover of the genome. There are future directions that we can talk about, and we have been talking about promoters. We might wanna know, just separate, how much if meiotic drive can explain any cases, how much X inhibition can explain, how much sexual antagonism can explain. I didn't tell you about, but we have many mitochondrial genes that are male bias, and many proteasome genes that are male bias and that are expressed only during spermatogenesis. And that might be also related to another conflict, because mitochondria is inherited only through females. So we are trying to know if the mitochondria is a little bit different during spermatogenesis. We are beginning to know, and we know more, and some other data, it's coming along on the Drosophila genome, that the export begins very early of these genes, and that some other types of genes are also export for different reasons, probably. And then we really want to know patterns in other organisms. And then X inactivation, and well, I think all the community wants to know if that's everywhere, or so we'll be working on that, all of us. And then X inactivation in Drosophila, we still don't have this cytological picture that I show you for mouse. So there is data on what genes express at every stage, and it seems to point to that, but it'd be nice to have that. And these are other things we are working on in the lab, and that.
Where did you tell that X inactivation in Drosophila? Don't you see the library?
No, in Drosophila that hasn't been seen. It was claimed that it's heteropignotic in melanogaster and probably pseudoscura, but we don't have the data, and we probably need to do some preparations for that. There is the data of people, Manuel Long has something in review that has the testes been dissected, the region where most of the things are not in meiosis yet, then things in meiosis and then postmeiotic cells, and trying to compare. There seems to be that the X express less, but is that real inactivation, or just you could regulate a chromosome? So, but still probably that already points to that, to the X inactivation, that support for that. And we have other data on when you transform, when you put a P element and insert in the X chromosome, it doesn't express in germline. So there is evidence of X inactivation. That's why we propose it. But we always thought it would be nice to get the picture.
Well, in humans, if X is inactivated late in embryogenesis, right? It's not inactivated right away.
No, it's inactivated at some point later, and every tissue just randomly chooses, so you can have chimeras. So it's not at the single cell that one X is inactivated and then all the organism is the same. It's later.
Which selects one of the other X
chromosomes? I think for humans it's random. For marsupial is the parental X that's inactivated. Mm-hmm.
So it's only random in some cell types. There are
X versions of the third X. Oh, for some cell types, it's not random.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just a picture of the people in the lab that are working or have been working on this, and a lot of the most recent things that I talked to you about, and a lot of what I didn't talk about, regulatory regions that we are exploring, was done by them. And definitely has been great to have the collaborators that are in this slide, that we've been working on this from Chicago, and Kaisman is now in Switzerland. We collaborated with Henrik and JJ in the human, and with Karen in the Drosophila paper. And we can keep discussing.